Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates. Ben LaForce, how are you, sir? You all right?
Doing all right. You getting on all right, Ben?
Very good, mate. Very good. Very good. It's Friday. I like Fridays. And then I have to sort of hide and do work during the weekends. So, you know, that's just the way it is.
It's Friday your time, so you're getting closer to, you know, G&Ts and fun.
Well, yeah, actually, this is my last meeting of the week, so this is good. This is the end of my week, working week, so it's actually quite good. But it's not quite G&T time, so I've got to sock a dad. I've got to take my son to some trials this evening, miles away or something like that. Anyway, doesn't really matter. Lovely to see you. I've said this before, but you are one of my favorite humans in legal tech, because for many, many reasons, and we'll get to the first one because there's a poster behind you, which is a Pearl Jam poster. And so we won't talk about Pearl Jam now because it'll just switch everyone off, but we'll talk about that later. But I think one of the things that I like about you, Glenn, is the fact that we can talk about pretty much anything, but I think the whole idea of this conversation is to sort of take us a little bit away from the day-to-day boringness, which sounds terrible, but it's not boring, of just legal tech. But I think what I'd love to understand and love to talk to you about is the whole journey that you've been on, because you've been in the industry for a long time. You've done lots of different jobs, different roles, different organizations. And I think part of it for me is you've got such a varied journey that I think that it's really interesting. And I think other people will be really interesting to understand sort of some of that anyway. So why don't you talk about you and where you are now initially, and then we can dive into sort of the past and the future and what the world holds and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am the Chief Knowledge and Innovation Officer at Holland & Knight. Holland & Knight, for those who don't know, is Am Law number 25. We're 2,300 lawyers, coming up on $2 billion in revenue. So large firm, predominantly U.S. presence, some LATAM and a small London office, but a large firm. The firm has experienced a ton of growth over the last 5 years. We've had two different combinations, one with a firm called Thompson & Knight out of Texas, another called Waller Lansdon out of Nashville. Couple that with a ton of lateral growth, we've gone from, you know, 1,000 lawyers and $1 billion in revenue to doubling that in 5 years. So with that comes a lot of interesting data journeys we have to go on, a lot of reconciling of our data, a lot of governance around it. So there's a lot to do here.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds like a tech company sort of in terms of that scale up journey, the immediateness of some of the tech companies that we see in the market and everything else in terms of their growth and what happens, maybe not on the same scale because, I mean, 2 billion's chunky numbers. But I think that does feel crazy, actually. I think that comes with those sort of combinations. And I think that's always interesting to see those combinations sort of take place because they're obviously always strategic, but it's the reasons behind the strategy for them delivering against that. But I think the challenge with all of these things I always see, as you sort of touched on it, is what happens afterwards and how long it takes you to get through the after effects. So in the same way of sort of like from my background, sort of when Thomson Reuters acquired HiQ, there was a whole data journey, sort of merging of teams, carving out different roles, responsibilities, understanding what that looks like. I think that is really hard, particularly from a technical perspective. Talk to me from a knowledge perspective. So how long have you been with the firm now? You've been...
So 14 months now. So still early days, but it was a new role created in the firm. you know, part of the reason is how do we take all this data and leverage it within this new platform, right? We've got, we combined with these two fantastic firms who had a wealth of experience regionally and in various sectors, like Waller was big in healthcare. How do we take all this data and all this internal knowledge and leverage this massive new platform we have? So they created the knowledge and innovation role, which is a rather broad role in the KM space. My team, we really run 10 functional areas. We have records, information governance, pricing, legal project management, research, competitive intelligence, knowledge management, legal tech, data strategy, and change management. So a very, very broad set of things, but they all really tie together, which is the interesting part of the journey. So we have 6 directors that that run those 10 functional areas.
But I think that's the thing. You sort of see more established firms, i.e. firms that haven't gone through that kind of combination in sort of the recent months and years, and you sort of look at it and they are naturally different teams that might fall under different sort of C-level kind of roles and responsibilities. I think it's probably been a good bet to put those 10 things under the same roof to achieve what you want to do in the short term that you need to do it, because otherwise, like little fiefdoms and little sort of create those sort of little silos, and you don't achieve ultimately what you need to do from a data perspective and sort of leveraging that and driving that forward. Ultimately, sort of the idea of these combinations is to sort of bring that business together and sort of see how that sort of operates. But ultimately, it's to drive new revenue and new revenue streams and new opportunities and sort of seeing how that sort of evolves.
That's exactly right. And I feel like this is, you know, the direction firms have been heading for, you know, maybe the last 5-10 years is looking at KM roles kind of more expansive than maybe more than the traditional roles, which were focused on, you know, forms, precedents, ground rule documents, curation. Now it's, you know, much more of a tech heavy role where you're partnering really, really closely with IT in order to get, you know, various user facing products and projects out the door.
Yeah. I was on a previous episode of Automate. So I was chatting to Ryan from Sente about sort of the change that he's, because he's sort of operating and he runs a consultancy called Sente, and he's working with 10 firms at any one time. And I was talking to him about sort of the changing face, or the almost like the chameleon nature of KM these days, in terms of you have to be tech first, you have to be data driven, you have to be these things, which traditionally they sort of weren't. There was, like, as you say, documents, precedents, sort of curation, all that sort of stuff. How have you seen the teams that you sort of, you're overarchingly responsible for, like the rise of the sort of the data side of things and the more technical things? Are you finding it sort of hard to recruit in those roles? Are you recruiting from out of industry because they've got the background? Because traditional KM people, you've got a thin sliver of those kinds of people who are sort of self-learning and building out and doing that. But if every law firm is moving in this direction, these experiences and these people are going to be few and far between.
It is hard to recruit for these roles because the people you're really looking for are the ones that do have a little bit of law firm experience. Maybe they're a lawyer and have transitioned more into kind of this tech forward type role. And, you know, those people are few and far between. You know, there's really just a handful of people you can think about that would be great fits in those types of roles. So, you know, once those people are off the board, you really start looking outside of legal and other places where, you know, hey, we work in professional services, whether that's somewhere coming out of the Big Four, organizations like that, that really could plug in to a law firm environment that understand data, but then understand what the flow is and how the user will work with the data. Yeah. Because, you know, part of KM is really the user experience as well. Yeah. And we talk about what is KM, because we get asked all the time within the elevators here, you know, what's our elevator pitch? It being new to the firm, you know, we had to have something tight. We always say it's here to increase profitable revenue, decrease costs, mitigate risk, and enhance the experience. And you really could fit just about anything into those 4 buckets, right? But it starts to really have that mindset with our team that if what we're doing doesn't fit in one of those four buckets, we probably shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah. No. And I mean, that's always really helpful to understand in terms of, I mean, I wish I had those sorts of things for some of the stuff I have to do. I mean, I don't look after 10 parts of our business because there probably aren't 10 parts in our business, but you know, it's sort of all of them come together and they sort of all have these things, but that kind of mantra is really good. I think
but the recruiting aspect, you know, just back to that real quick. I mean, we were fortunate, you know, the firm funded this new endeavor of knowledge and innovation, funded going out and hiring people, you know, some key leadership positions, new directors, and then letting them bring their lieutenants in underneath. So we were able to, you know, hire some people within the industry that were, you know, very well known. Michelle Gossmeyer for information governance, Sam Whitman for KM, Emily Rushing for data strategy. They were able to then hire some really good technical people under them or some governance people. And we've really started to get this, you know, ball rolling here.
No, I mean, and yeah. So across those 10 units, how many people will fall under that sort of scope, that sort of thing?
Yeah, just north of 110. Wow. And you look at that and you're like, you know, holy crap, 110 KM people. It's not 110 KM people. You know, yeah. We have, you know, 40 information governance people because we have 33 offices and we have to have somebody in records in each office. You know, we have a research team that's got about, you know, 25, 30 people. So the bulk of the team comes within those two functional areas. You know, the smaller teams are the pricing team, the legal project management team, data strategy, change management, knowledge management. Those are just getting going because they're new to the firm. The other ones were more, well, pricing wasn't new, but the other ones were inherited.
Yeah. I think that's sort of, that's a key. So in your strategic planning, as part of sort of delivering against the firm's vision and sort of looking at that, is that team in 3 years, 200 people? Is that team?
Not at all. You know, the data strategy team will always be lean and mean. You know, it's not something where you just throw more bodies at it and you do things faster. You know, there's an order of operations to get things done. You know, it's just like developing software. You know, when you're trying to do an implementation, hey, you know, three core people that are working on an implementation are going to get something just as done as fast as throwing 50 people at it, which would cause us confusion. So, you know, that team will always be, you know, lean and mean. KM, you know, eventually we want to build out more of our knowledge management attorney program, which we don't have here at the firm. So we'll have some more bodies there, but you know, that team's not going to get much bigger than it is now. So, and we're pretty much at the, you know, at the end of the line from a hiring perspective, other than a couple, you know, key strategic.
Must be a relief.
A lot of team building, right? I mean, you know, when I joined, you know, we didn't have all these things in place. So, you know, the first 6 months is laying the groundwork, setting the strategy, putting the projects in motion, but then hiring these people that can execute on it.
Yeah. I mean, I know we joked about this when we caught up at ILTA, but it's like sort of there's parts of my job I love. Managing people is not one of those things. Now, you didn't say that, but ultimately, if you're overarchingly responsible for 110 people, then there is a big HR part of that. How do you sort of create the level of focus that you need to do your job and then still and not forget about that stuff because it's important, but how do you focus on the strategic aspect of what you're doing? Is it the directors that you've hired and the responsibility you give them?
A lot of it is that. I mean, look, people take up a lot of time and they're very important and you want to keep them motivated and happy and you know, when the issues arise, you need to address them quickly. So there is a lot of rah-rah that goes into this type of role. But the key to actually executing and getting it done is A, being intentional about carving out time to actually sit and think and do the strategy and travel around and talk to the key stakeholders. Like I said, we're 2,300 lawyers. We're north of 1,000 partners. A lot of my first year was traveling office to office to find out, you know, what each practice group's issues are, whether it's people, process, you know, data or tech, find out what's going on so we can start setting the strategy. And then really, Ben, it's hiring good people you can trust that are going to go out, that know their business, that you know are going to execute, to help, you know, augment the strategy, you know, tell you your strategy shit if it is, and here's what you should do next, right? That it will be collaborative, and then go out and get it done.
Yeah, definitely. And that makes sense. I think one of the things that is interesting about your journey is because you haven't always been inside of a firm. I mean, obviously you've been at Holland Knight. Before that, you've had other sort of firm, but you've been on the vendor side as well. And I think talk to me about that sort of journey, the kind of roles that you did. And I think one of the things that's really interesting, because I've done it the other way around. I did sort of 10 years at a firm, did sort of 15, 14 number of years in different vendors. But the idea that you take different parts of your experiences to create you as an executive, a C-level or whatever. Talk to me about your journey and the things that you sort of see and how you've blended that.
Yeah. So I started out in legal, you know, 22, 23 years ago. I was a history secondary education major in college, was going to teach high school history, did my student teaching and said, oh, crap, I don't want to do this. This was a terrible idea. graduated and not sure what I was going to do. My brother was with LexisNexis and he said, hey, we're moving people from software to .com. We need adult teachers to come in and work with the lawyers to show them this new platform. Sign me up. I needed a job out of university, right? So that's how I got into legal. And I was working in Washington, D.C. at the time. I was training lawyers that were from large West Coast-based firms. So, you know, Latham, you know, Paul Hastings, firms like that. And really started kind of getting into this and liking this whole legal thing. My family was very legal-focused. So my brother ended up actually going to work at Latham. My mother was one of the last remaining employees of Howery, and my wife was in knowledge management at Cleary Gottlieb. So kind of fell into this whole world here. you know, did Lexis for about a dozen years in a variety of different roles. And during the recession, moved to Atlanta when we had our first child, better cost of living, more expansive role with Lexis. Then I transitioned over to Handshake Software. Which was kind of a little bit of a leap of faith at the time, right? Because Lexis is this well-known established organization and Handshake is, you know, a small up-and-coming legal tech company. It'd been around, but was starting to try to figure out how to reinvent itself and get some more growth. So I went over there as the chief strategy officer, did that for a number of years. And that role was fantastic because what it got me to do is work with so many different resources in a firm. And a very collaborative approach to take what in essence Handshake was a toolkit. And so you're solving business challenges with a set of tools rather than pushing necessarily a set SKU or set product to users. So I got to collaborate with CIOs around the world, with CKOs around the world, and come up with some very new creative things around that. We sold that company to Aderant, so I went over there for a little bit, but really was trying to figure out what was the next step after that. Never had thought about working in a law firm. I mean, didn't even cross my mind. And probably actively would have said no chance as well. And then one of my clients at Handshake, Meredith Williams Range, pulled me aside at ILTA. She had just moved to Sherman and said, hey, I'm creating this role that really combines kind of the front and back half of your career. It's director of knowledge and research. So it's everything you've done kind of in your Handshake days and everything you did in your Lexis days. Would you be interested in moving to a firm? And I said, absolutely not. No, I like this vendor side. She goes, well, we're going to rip out all of our systems and re-architect this from the ground up. And we're going to do it in 3 years. Does that sound interesting to you? And I was like, well, nobody's really done that because you rip out a core system like every 3 or 4 years. And over a 12-year span, you do it. But
yeah, exactly.
Tell me a little bit more. Oh, we're going to do a data lake too. So for those of you who know Meredith, she's very compelling and will sell you on just about anything. Yeah, so
it's very hard to say no, it's Meredith. So
very hard to say no. So, but that sounded really, really interesting to me. It sounded like kind of a next evolution and step in my career. So, you know, took that role, spent 4.5 years at Sherman, started as the director, became the CKO. We did you know, exactly what was advertised there. We re-architected the systems. We put a lake house in the middle of it. And it was fantastic. And that kind of led to this next step. You know, part of this role here at Holland & Knight, we, the COO here at Holland & Knight was the executive director at Sherman when the whole program started there. So she had the vision of what it could be and what success looked like and said, okay, we were very successful there and what we were trying to do. How do we do that over here? And that's how
she
I ended up.
And she chose you.
Well, they put us through a nice rigorous process as firm should do, right? But yeah, you know.
You've done it. So you, a big part of that is success breeds success. If you've achieved, as you said, the lofty ambitions of Meredith in trying to achieve what she achieved in 3 years, 4 years, whatever it might be at Sherman. As you said, we both know 25 years and typically most technology, most juicy, chunky technology has got at least a 5 year, 6 year shelf life, if not longer. If you look at your PMS and stuff like that, you're thinking much longer than that. So yeah, in order to rip stuff out, to put stuff in, that's aggressive, but as you say, it's exciting because you're still doing it.
At the leapfrog competitors. Now, you know, the thing that we also bring to the table here at Holland & Knight is, you know, the failures along the way, right? It's not all roses and successes. You know, we had some nice crash and burns along the way that we learned from and that you take into this new firm and say, okay, let's not do it that way because of X, Y, or Z, right? End of the day, you know, it's not, you know, an apples for apples. What we did at Sherman's, what we're doing at Holland & Knight, right? Our IT team has done a fantastic job of getting us to the cloud and getting those core systems done before this program was created. So yeah. Now we're coming in and we're looking at, hey, you know, Lake House, how can AI help us? And I know we're not going to go down an AI tangent. It's beaten to death enough, but
you know, it's been 21 and a half minutes and we've not even mentioned it. It's like a record.
Amazing, right? It's amazing. But how do we take, you know, all the good structural work that our IT department's done over the number of years getting us ready for this next venture that we're in? And now let's put the lake house on. Now let's start leveraging the data from this newly combined platform.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. I think so I mentioned a conversation I had with Ryan quite a couple of months ago. I had a conversation with Alex Smith of iManage 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, something like that. And he was talking about the benefits of that foundational work that you do. You've got lofty like missions and objectives and things that you want to achieve, but actually the hard yards of getting through that stuff. So it sounds like your IT function has really given you a really amazing platform to then drive that success and accelerate some of those things, which is, I mean,
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. You know, you walk into a new role, you're already on 365 for mail as well. There's a plan in place to take iManage to the cloud, which has been executed on now. You know, there's ideas of how do we take our financial system and manage services a little bit down the road. You know, very much a cloud first organization, which is, you know, which is great to walk into, right? I mean, that's what you want. Hey, let's leverage APIs instead of data centers. I mean,
yeah,
100%. It's a dream come true for someone who's in my role.
Yeah, 100%. Because you're not, I think one of the things I hear and have heard for 10, 15 years is that oftentimes the battles that sort of more tech-minded knowledge sort of teams have with the underlying technology teams, because the tech guys have got an agenda and it doesn't always align with knowledge and what knowledge is trying to achieve, because it's sort of back in the old days, it was lights on, make sure things are happening and working. It wasn't a consideration of how productive people are and how effective they can work and what does all that mean. But I think that drive towards innovation, I guess, in that sense is really changing that dynamic.
It's got to be a partnership. Right. Yeah. You have to be aligned with your IT function in order to breed success. You follow each other. So, you know, one of the things we were very successful in my prior role was, you know, we had such a close relationship with the IT department. You know, we're pretty much inseparable and we're building that here as well, where we can, you know, bounce ideas off each other. We were showing each other the roadmap ahead of time, trying to organize everything and say, okay, this is where we need you to come in, and getting guidance back and forth, right? Yeah. So going back to what I said, when, you know, you hire directors and you got to be comfortable with them telling you this is crap. Both sides of the house between IT and the K&I function have to be able to say, this is not the best way to do it. And you have to be willing to take that on the chin, both sides.
Yeah. Yeah, no, 100%. And that kind of collaborative approach, is that's where I sort of see perhaps more, some of the more smaller firms do really well, because there isn't sort of big 200 man teams across 50 offices and all that sort of stuff. I know you're smaller, but, you know, in terms of those different things, that is a really hard kind of, you've got to take everyone on the journey. But if you've got a team of 110 knowledge and innovation people and a similar number of IT people, if not maybe a bit more, you've got to take 200 plus people all on the same journey. And that takes cooperation, collaboration. It takes sort of top down, but also bottom up stuff. You got to think about how you're sort of bringing different people together.
And then ultimately that journey is taking 2,300 lawyers on the journey together, right? Yeah. And that's, you know, that's what you have to look at, is it's the user base, right? How does this impact our users? How does this impact our lawyers to bill in, you know, tenths of an hour? How does this increase revenue, decrease cost, decrease risk, enhance our experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think the you've got that mantra really wrapped down really well. That little four pillar thing. I like that. I like that. Just rolls.
We've been you know, evolving that for, you know, 5-6 years at this point. So
you mentioned one of the teams is change management, and I think the when you're introducing new technology or new processes or that sort of cultural change of being more collaborative and everything else, it ultimately is, I mean, 90% of what we do in all of our lives is change. It's managing change, adjusting to change, reacting to change, all that sort of stuff. How your change team, is that focused in on, not organizational change probably, but what is it, technical? Is it adoption? It's lawyer facing.
It's all of that. It's use case, uncovering different use cases. It's a lawyer facing role. It's a small team right now that we're, again, building out, but we're building it out purposefully based on demand and projects. It's really, how do we get ahead of any sort of rollout? How do we get ahead of any sort of project with engagement? So, you know, traditionally in a law firm, there's an email that comes out that says, iManage is going to be down for the weekend because of some sort of upgrade. Inherently, somebody misses the email because, you know, they get blasted with all sorts of internal emails that, you know, aren't clients. They don't care. The lawyers don't care about them.
Yeah.
So inherently they're missed. How do we impact this change more purposefully so they can, you know, understand what's coming, accept what's coming, because acceptance is part of it, and then adapt. Yeah. And, you know, that could be, you know, different ways of engagement, whether it's in-office events, whether it's, you know, flyers, whether it's different forms of communication on meeting the lawyer where they work versus trying to push something to them where they might ignore it. So yeah. a great example is we did during the iManage rollout, when we upgraded to the cloud, you know, we had an outage over the weekend purposefully for that last set of migration, you know, weeks ahead of time. We're hitting them with flyers in their office, like we were dorm storming back in university. You know, we're sending text out. We're updating the intranet. We're doing in-person engagement luncheons on what is changing and how does it impact you? How will this impact how you access your documents, how you store documents? What do you do during this, you know, 48, 72-hour outage? Who do you call if you need documents for a deal closing over the weekend that's going to close on Monday morning? Even our chair at his address a week beforehand, we got him to mention that iManage was going to be out during his firm-wide address. So different ways from that perspective, you know, that's kind of one side of it. And it was very successful. We had zero complaints that somebody missed it, which is spectacular with 2,300 lawyers. So it's unprecedented. Yeah. You know, the other side of it is from the change management is understanding a little bit more of the use cases that go around any sort of technology we're thinking of rolling out. So, you know, we're really good at rolling at doing proof of values before we do any sort of implementation. And that's very different than a proof of concept. You know, does the technology work?
Yeah.
When we do a proof of value of a product, it's really, do we derive the value from this product that you as the supplier, vendor, say we are?
Yeah, 100%.
Are our lawyers using it, right? So when we do a proof of value, we have change management work with our lawyers as well to figure out how to get this within their workflow, how to come up with use cases. Because, you know, I'll do one little AI bit. When I was playing with Copilot, I used the heck out of it for the first 2 weeks. And then I didn't use it for about 2 months. And it's because I never adopted it into my workflow. So I had to stop and go back and figure out, okay, how am I going to re-architect my workflow to include this tool, which will provide me tangible benefits down the road? You know, yeah. That's a function that we use change management for.
Okay. And I guess that's a really good example, isn't it? Because, I mean, obviously AI is AI. It's everywhere. It's the most important thing ever. Even more important.
Right, most important thing ever. But how do we get it into our lawyer's workflow? That's the critical part. Because otherwise, it's a nifty tool to have, but how do our lawyers actually use it in a meaningful way?
Yeah. I mean, you know what we do. We do process orchestration. We're sort of playing around with the ideas of how do we facilitate that? What does that look like? And we've done some really interesting stuff, like proof of values, really, as you described them, with some clients. But starting to look at, actually, does the lawyer need to know that it's AI that's doing something? I mean, if you look at any other piece of technology, if you look at an old, I don't know, like Litera Compare or something else, the lawyer never questioned how the red lines got on the document. They never questioned what they did. They never questioned any of those things. What they did was they pressed a couple of buttons and they got the output. Now, so there's a lot of things that we're doing that basically means that the outcome is presented to the lawyer. The lawyer hasn't had to think about the prompt, hasn't had to think about what it is. They might not have even done the step before the output is required to land on their desk. They've just received the output because somebody else has done something else in the process. But they don't really need to know whether it was Claude 3.5 or Meta Llama or this or that or whatever. It doesn't matter, ultimately. What matters is, how's the process been orchestrated? How's it been audited? How's it been tracked? How's it been sort of maintained and managed? And is it delivering the outputs they're expecting? And I think a lot of time we talk to customers and we see all of the like the tech solutions and all the other bits and pieces, and they're almost point of need. I'm going to go somewhere to do something, rather than, to your point, actually, I know I'm going to get value from this, but I almost will be lazy and not go there, and I'll do it the old way because I normally do it the old way, so I just do that.
Right.
How do we train on how to do it the old way? Exactly. So how do you change those processes? And again, that's again another whole change sort of management thing. So starting to look at how that's.
I mean that's the big challenge. You know, there are two things you touched on there though that I want to point out. You know, one, the lawyers never questioned how it was done when you were doing the Litera Compare example, right? Do you know who else never questioned it? The clients.
Yeah.
Right. There's AI behind that, you know, machine learning before, but that wasn't anywhere inside the outside counsel guidelines before. Now, exactly. With this whole hype of AI, now you're starting to see it appear everywhere in the outside counsel guidelines.
Yeah.
Second thing, from a barrier to adoption of generative AI, lawyers are really great at writing prompts and they don't know it.
Yeah, 100%.
Every day a partner is writing an email prompting an associate of exactly what to do for this particular matter. It's trying to get the workflow changed from, instead of writing that email prompt, maybe putting that into the AI and, you know, turning that loose and then copying the associate. You know, there's different ways to do it there, but lawyers are really great at writing prompts.
I was chatting to somebody. It was Tess, actually, again, on this podcast a few episodes ago. Tess from Charles.
I've been plugging the podcast every 3 seconds.
It's quite evergreen content. It's wonderful. But Tess was talking about how a couple of people in her team who are ex-lawyers and research assistants who have for years been doing research and understanding what needs the lawyers have at certain points in time. And they're now becoming like prompt ninjas. They are the focus of how they deliver their prompt library for different components and different things. And I think that's prompt ninja is not a thing. I just made that up. But ultimately, it's the concept of the lawyer being the best person to think about the prompts is you can see why, because they understand the subject. They understand what the nature of it is. They know what the outcomes might need to be. This is going to sound terrible, but they're used to telling people what to do to get to the outcomes that they want. So sort of 5-year qualified, asking a certain client, 2-year qualified, go and do this job, but do it in this way and give me this output and make sure it's formatted like this. And they'll get them to do it again if it isn't quite right. But I think that's the kind of mindset that's where you can see lawyers adopting this technology sort of more and more in that sense.
And I agree. And I'm absolutely going to rob Prompt Ninja. We are going to turn that loose on our change management team, and we're going to leverage that phrase. And when I come up with a really cool little badge or logo, I'll send it over to you.
Perfect. Just chuck it into ChatGPT and it'll do it. That's fine.
There you go.
So one of the things that I sort of I was conscious of as we were sort of crafting the sort of the outline for this conversation is, you've gone from sort of C-level chief strategy officer in a relatively, not small, but as you described it, sort of smaller than Lexus legal tech vendor, gone into sort of director and C-level roles now. What are the tips that you can give people that maybe might want to sort of not do lawyering anymore and want to go into tech or want to do this? What are the transitions, the cultural balances? What are the things that you go, right, Glenn, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, but do these three things and you'll be good?
I think the first thing is going out and, you know, getting plugged into the community. The CAM community is so evangelical with the information. Everybody shares, everybody takes the time to mentor each other, but either formally or informally. You have to do a lot of listening and then start putting all the pieces together, almost like you're playing Tetris, right? You go to these conferences, you hear one person speak about this, you hear the other person speak about this, and, you know, seek them out afterwards, I think is one of the big things if you're trying to get into these roles and move up or transition out and say, this was great. You told me X, Y, and Z here at this conference. What didn't go right during that? Because at most of these conferences, it's all about, you know, look at me, I've done this great thing, you can do it too. Now, some people go in and say, and this is where I screwed up, which to me is the most valuable thing. But take those people aside, have those conversations, build those relationships. I would say within a given month, I'll talk to 6 or 7 of my peers, and not the same people, each month, of just, hey, what's going on? What are you working on? And we're collaborative from that type of information. And, you know, hey, is this product working for you? Is this process working for you? So kind of back to the core question, go out and build relationships, go out and find formal or informal mentors to bring you along the way. And I was fortunate to have, you know, many of those guide me throughout my career, both, you know, when I was on the vendor side and at the firm side. And there's still people that are trusted advisors that I go to. Yeah. I think one of the things for me that was a barrier to entry into law firms was not being a lawyer. You know, there's very few people in my role that aren't lawyers. You know, kind of Tom Baldwin was the first one that kind of had these types of roles that wasn't a law lawyer. You know, Kate Kane's kind of made that transition now as well. So it's becoming more and more prevalent. But it's something that I think is, you know, it's not as much a barrier to entry as it was before. You know, is it a necessity? No. Has it helped that, you know, the people I named, you know, Kate, Tom, myself, have spent our entire careers inside legal, right? So it's like we went to law school. But I think that barrier has slowly been broken down a little bit.
No, and that makes sense. I think you talked to two things. I often talk about this idea that I get this whole imposter syndrome because I'm not a trained lawyer. I dropped out of university. I got rubbish results in my A levels and other things. But I think there's that balance to all of those things. So I'm in an environment where everyone's an expert because they've trained at being an expert. All the lawyers, and I'm not making shit up, but I am sort of making shit up. But it's just the experience you get from 25 years in the industry of working for a law firm, doing a whole bunch of different things, and then trying to make sure that you're in front of the lawyers and trying to make sure that you're listening to understand what their problems are, so that as an IT guy, as I was, I'm not just delivering technology, I'm delivering solutions to problems and starting to think about how that sort of works.
And going back to the whole listening standpoint, right? So when I was in my handshake days, you know, meeting with CKOs and CIOs at, you know, a firm in Australia, then doing that in continental Europe, then doing that over here and starting to kind of piece together everything, and, you know, both similarities and differences and culture and what they're doing with tech and how they're presenting information to their lawyers, I would make an argument that that gives you greater experience in the knowledge management space than, you know, just being a solicitor at a firm in London for, you know, 10 years, right?
Yeah, 100%. Because it's
experience, right? And it goes back to the core function of what are we doing now from a KM and what is a KM function today versus what it was. And if those are important roles. I'm not minimizing, you know, the hiring of people like Sam Whitman, right? Sam was he's one of my trusted advisors on my team, who practiced in London for years, you know, worked in KM for years and has that lawyer brain that I bounce things off of. You know, those are very important roles, but you know,
probably the most important thing Sam's ever done for me, maybe not for you, but for me, is introduce me to ranch water. That's the thing. That is a thing.
He introduced me to ranch water, that might go under the mistakes made type category versus the success.
I don't know. There's a big thing. So there is no, so you can buy cans of ranch water. It was in Nashville when we were in Ilta and everything else, but it's impossible to get here in the UK. So I'm now thinking maybe I need to transition out of legal tech and I just need to become an importer of ranch water.
Ranch water distributor?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, it's hard to find here in Atlanta and I'm not far from Nashville. It's kind of pretty regional, although Sam seems to be able to find it just fine at his house. So
exactly, I think I need to go to him to be the distributor. Yeah, it's fine.
Exactly.
I think you also said something just around mentors, mentees. But I think one of the things that I've always loved about this industry. So when I joined HighQ, sort of I got wrapped into the kind of experience that you described. I'd go to 150 different sort of firms who are the clients, you talk to knowledge people, IT people, you talk to the practices, you talk to all these, and you start to absorb little nuggets of insight, but each one's slightly different. Sort of mainland Europe and in the Nordics is like, they have a very direct way of doing things. It's different to how London operates. It's different to New York, which is different to sort of Kansas and Australia and all the different places, but you start to build up that mental map of everything else. But I think The one thing I would advocate, which you did as well, the thing that this place is for me is just one big community. Whether you're on the tech side or the knowledge side or the innovation side, everyone's just really open and really sort of chilled and sort of, I mean, yeah, there are people that aren't, but you know, ultimately on the whole, everyone's willing to have a conversation. Good people.
And that's what you're looking for in a professional career, right? Just surround yourself with good people that are willing to just, you know, help you along. And I've been fortunate in my career that so many people have just helped me along. And that's, you know, that's key. That's what I try to do with other people now is, you know, okay, now I've gotten here. How can I get you there as well?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I look at WhatsApp or iMessage or whatever, and it's sort of the top five of the top 10 things are industry people. But that's because I'm always like, I'm either asking questions or I'm getting asked questions or whatever it might be. It's just the way that it sort of operates. Otherwise just work would be boring. I mean, you know, they're so, boring decks, but you know.
As we come here towards a close, I think you need to tell this audience about your Pearl Jam story from Hyde Park, because I think it's freaking awesome and hilarious.
So Pearl Jam story. So you were over in London. I had tickets to go and see Pearl Jam on the Saturday night. I saw you post on a social media platform that you'd gone to the Friday night. And I said, what the beep? You're in London, ? Da, 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 da. And basically you'd gone to Wimbledon and done all sorts of other stuff that week and everything else. And I was going, I'm there tomorrow. And you went, well, so am I. And I went, you're going twice? So I know you've gone to Pearl Jam like 100 times or 50 times or 36 times or whatever it is. So I'm like going, right, we need to hook up. So I'm coming up. So I live on the Isle of Wight. So I'm traveling up with two friends from the island. I'm meeting two friends from my university time who are headmasters. And then there's a couple of other extra randoms. And then you and your friend Kit came along.
Yep.
And so there was this like merge of different parts of my life.
Both worlds colliding for you.
Exactly. But it was a glorious day. I mean, the sun was shining, Pearl Jam were awesome. It was just great. It was absolutely fantastic. The story, though, the real story, is at the end of the year, Christmas time, we're sort of sat around the family table, we're chatting, and my wife asked the question, so looking back over the year, what was your favorite day? What was the favorite thing you happened to you this year? And like my daughter, who's 11, she was sort of saying something. I can't remember what it was because I'm a terrible father, but she was saying something really nice and family orientated. My boys were talking about football. And then my wife turned to me and said, so what was your day? What was your favorite thing? And like my wife was half expecting me to say something about the family. And I said, when I went to Pearl Jam with Glenn. And it sort of literally killed Christmas. It didn't kill Christmas for everyone, but in my house, there was a moment of, I'm sorry, what the? And it was, anyway, that's my story. That's my story.
Love the honesty, because you know what? I would have just stuck with the lie, and then the back of my head said I was a little bit dishonest and, you know, kind of dealt with it. But you went for it, and God bless you. That's fantastic.
I wasn't smart enough.
It really
enough
was like one of the best days of the year, Ben. I'm with you. I mean, it was
amazing. It was glorious, but it was I just wasn't smart or quick enough. Smart or quick enough to come up with a suitable lie, because it would have been obvious. Pearl Jam. But you've just been to Pearl Jam. You did Pearl Jam in Boston.
I went on a Tuesday at Fenway. It was the last show in the door. So I got there this year, and it was number 36. So my entire office is decorated in Pearl Jam concert posters, one behind me, all over. It's been, you know, 25 years of going to see him.
My office is decorated in cheap plywood. So, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah, Pearl Jam poster. I'll send you a London one.
Yeah, up right there. I'll get some Pearl Jam posters next time. Ben, you're an absolute legend. Thank you for this. I think everyone's going to listen to this and sort of take something away from it, whether it be the community, just the cultural changes, what you're trying to achieve at Holland Night and everything else. So it's awesome. Thank you for taking the time. Enjoy your weekend. Stay safe, and I will catch you very soon.
All right, you too, bud. I really enjoyed it. Go Chelsea.
Oh, no, gonna cut that, definitely.